Coming up in this week in computer hardware, GTX 980 Ti rumors. What's up with 300 series AMD cards? Google I.O. brings new Android Brillo Pay. HP does 3D printing and an enterprise spanking. All that and more. It's coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 317, recorded May 28, 2015. GPU rumors and Google I.O. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, most delightful, and yes, once in a while, the most controversial commentary on PC and mobile hardware, phones, tablets. We love them. Of course, gaming and video editing and rendering and just plain typing on the desktop is really at the core of our souls, our little, dark, black, evil souls. Joining me right now, actually, I shouldn't say our, it's my little, dark, black, evil soul, the soul of light and joy. Joining me right now, Mr. Ryan Shrouts. That was perhaps the weirdest introduction yet. You look.
It's probably up there. I'm not going to lie. But I'll take it. We're here. We're golden. We're good. And a lot of stuff happened this week, as it turned out, as I look down the list of stuff. So,
well, let's just leap straight into all of it. Like, big news today, of course, earlier today, Google I.O. took place. If you were watching live or if you were watching, you know, the coverage on Twit, basically hours of Google I.O. Google I.O. is, of course, Google's version of Intel Developers Forum or Microsoft Build, or we could go on for a while, but it's where they introduce the new and exciting things to their developer community. The big one, of course, is the Android M developer preview and tools. Pretty much went up. M will be named for, we presume, some sort of M-like candy. But it's pretty cool. I mean, you know, giving users control of app permissions in the M release. Apps can trigger requests for permissions at runtime, app links. Android devices will be smarter about managing power through a new feature called Doze. So, you know, now on tap is going to be sort of automated assistance. And, of course, the really big development in there would be Android Pay, which, guess what, is keeping Android in parity or stepping up. Google Payment's been around for a while, but obviously Apple's Pay system has been a big deal. So now there is an Android Pay system. You know, so that you too can commit your entire life to your cell phone and be.
You sound pessimistic about it. I hadn't heard about the Google Pay stuff at all. I mean, does it seem comparable? I mean, the benefit of Apple Pay, or one of the big benefits, I guess, is that kind of fingerprint sensor security that is kind of built into their phones.
With Android Pay, you can simply unlock your phone like you normally do, place it near a merchant's contactless terminal, and you're good to go. Android Pay does all the heavy lifting. Goodness, if I could speak.
Heavy living would be it too. Sure.
Heavy living. Yeah, I mean, tap to pay in apps. You'll be able to pay with your credit card or debit card across multiple Android devices. Android Pay. I mean, basically, it's the same. I would assume it's essentially the same hardware that's being used in Apple Pay. I mean, because you look at the Android Pay in stores, you know, Android Pay will soon be accepted at over 700,000 store locations from your favorite brands across the U.S. and in over 1,000 Android apps, and we'll be adding more every day. So it's like, you know, Aeropostal, American Eagle Outfitters, Best Buy, Bloomingdale's, Coca-Cola, GameStop, Jamba Juice, JetBlue, Macy's, McDonald's, Office Depot, Panera Bread, Pepsi, Petco, Sports Authority, Staples, Subway, Toys R Us, Walgreens, Whole Foods. You know, and then it's like, oh, I can use Android Pay in, you know, B&H Photos, Chipotle, Domino's, Dunkin' Donuts, E24, Etsy, Eventsbrite, Groupon, Grubhub, Hotel Tonight, Jack Threads Living, blah, 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 Lyft and Uber, Newegg. Noticing a decided lack of Amazon on that list. But, you know, I don't understand why I would need it for Amazon. But I'm a simple creature. I think part of the reason I'm a little cautious about this is because, you know, somewhere within reach of me is a GoRuck with an envelope from Wells Fargo with a replacement credit card with a chip embedded in it, because they're just getting really frustrated. They replaced my credit card from like one of the two Target purchases I made, in the previous, umpteen months, and then Home Depot got hacked. So it's an interesting question, right? Because, several weeks after, one of Apple's online services got slammed, much to the embarrassment and irritation several Hollywood stars, right? That they're like, well, we have everything secured. Don't mind that thing with our online service. It was a mistake. And you're going to put your entire financial life on your phone. It's interesting. I'm curious. I think it was necessary and going to happen. I'd love to see over the next year, what percentage of retail sales migrate to Android or iOS devices. It's kind of funny. The other thing that was dropped today, my personal favorite article being the Variety article, HBO Now coming to Google Play and Chromecast. Not that we didn't know that. It's been available on Apple TV. I didn't realize it was available also in Cablevision systems. And then, quote, in the near future, unquote, Sundar Pichai said, Google Senior Vice President. And it'll be available on the Android TV connected television platform, which is good because I just dropped $200 for one of the new NVIDIA television boxes, Android TV boxes. So, a lot of not necessarily hardcore hardware news coming out of Google I/O. But the other one that was a big deal to me, at least, as I putter around getting Windows 10 Internet of Things version running on a Raspberry Pi, was the Brillo announcement, which is Google's operating system for the Internet of Things. Developers preview is not going to come until Q3. Ross Miller writes up on The Verge. But it's interesting. They're basically saying, and I'm going to quote Mr. Miller on this one. Brillo is derived from Android, but is polished to just the lower levels, supports Wi-Fi, Bluetooth Low Energy, and other Android things. And then in Q4, there will be Weave, which is a cross-platform language that will let Brillo, quote, devices, phones, the internet, all talk to one another. I'll be curious to see how this works out. A friend of mine continues to joke that only 80% of his life is on Google, and he's just trying to get that last, 10 or 20% on there.
Pretty close to that.
Apparently,
yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, Apple buys Nest. Apple will come out with HomeKit, possibly not at the Apple Developers Conference, although it is pretty. They just announced
Google bought Nest, not Apple. Right.
Sorry, Google bought Nest. I'm sorry. It all gets so confusing with all these purchases. Thank you for that correction. Yeah, I'm curious to watch all of this kind of consolidate. And
what did you think about the Android TV stuff? Because I actually we have one of the Shields here, and we are messing around with it for a little bit. I'm trying not to break any HDMI cables that are connected to it. And it actually it works surprisingly well. Like we had it hooked up to this TV behind us actually as it just powers off, but it was actually really cool to see it all kind of work. It's a much better implementation than what you get with Apple TV, right? But I was glad to hear you mention the HBO Go and Now stuff, because that's kind of like the biggest thing missing from what Android TV is today as I used it, over the last handful of days. There's no Amazon Prime streaming either, which is, Amazon has their own competing platform, so will they bring it over to it? I think they will eventually. I think they have to realize that they're still the small guy in that battle.
Yeah. It was interesting for me watching, one of the other announcements that happened in the last few days was Windows announcing that there would be iOS apps and Android apps for Cortana and various other, Windows services. And in part, when you've got 2% of the mobile market, moving it on to the other 95, the two operating systems that cover the other 90 or 95% of the market would probably be a really good idea. It's been interesting because while I saw Android Auto and got to spend some time with it at CES, it's been funny because all the Android Auto reviews have been coming out and being like, I saw that at CES. But now, of course, it's in cars and Apple and Android are fighting over the, control of the dashboard experience. I haven't had any time with Android TV. So as much as I didn't want to spend $200 on another set-top box because, You know, at this point, I have several that I won't even mention because the companies have gone down in flames, plus the Apple TV and the Roku 3 that are in heavy rotation, plus the stuff built into the Blu-ray player, plus the home theater TV. my wife's going to be like, what are you doing? You know, about the only one I don't have running at home is the Amazon Fire TV. But everybody I know who's seen this has said it feels fantastic. And I, you know, as an Apple TV user and somebody who's been buying iTunes content for a long time, I think that's fantastic because it's going to, you know, we already anticipate that there's going to be a huge Apple announcement later this year. And this is going to force Apple to really step up their game because, you know, I don't particularly... You know, once it got to the point where I could eliminate the 33 things I don't use on Apple TV and get rid of those chiclets, you know, the Apple TV interface is fast enough that I'm fairly happy with it. I would like that, you know, apps on the Apple TV platform were updated as regularly as they were on other platforms. Netflix, right. You know, for example, HBO Now is very usable. iTunes obviously is. So I think it's going to run fine on the Apple TV. But I'm really curious to see what comes out in the next generation of Apple TV. Not particularly thrilled like, hey, I'm going to talk to my remote control and launch, you know, Phineas and Ferb. You know, maybe the talking to my remote control will grow on me after time.
But Phineas and Ferb is a good show.
Phineas and Ferb is a fantastic show. Yes. And if I were going to, you know, it's funny. Like I can see the first time my three-year-old figured out all of the remote controls, much to right. my wife's horror. But it's interesting to watch. It's interesting to watch how small children and middle-aged adults deal with new technology. you know, at both ends of that spectrum, the reaction can be frustration and anger.
That's or pretty
just,
funny.
Yeah. Automatically assimilating it. So yeah, you know, ton of Google I/O news this week, obviously. Interesting story came up. You guys linked to it on PC Per was that older versions of the Android operating system or older phones with the Android operating system. What is it? The quote, I'm going to quote Jeremy up on PCPro.com. Quote, it seems that the factory reset for Android 4.3 and below is flawed and that researchers were able to recover data from wiped phones. You know, the Register wrote the article up on this. Something like a half a billion Android phones could have data recovered and Google accounts compromised thanks to flaws in the default wiping feature. University of Cambridge scientists Lauren Simon and Ross Anderson have claimed. Google did not respond to the Register when they asked them about it. That's a pretty given, you know, on one hand, a lot of people aren't recycling their phones or selling their phones because, you know, you don't make any money off them. Although I was fascinated to find out there's a cell phone recycling kiosk that's showing up. You know, they have a couple thousand locations around the United States. And I laugh because like an iPhone 4S, they'll give you like, you know, $20 for it, maybe $5 for it. And, you know, other phones, you'll get literally like $5 for it. You know, it's kind of nasty. You know, because the article says the researchers had a success rate of 80% for recovering tokens for Google and Facebook, could even recover encryption keys, you know, and the keys were encrypted, but they could be brute forced. So Jeremy notes that you need to encrypt your phone with a long password before you wipe it and sell it, give it away, or toss it out. So, you know, that's, you know, given how, in you know, given how creative the thievery community has gotten about stealing things that they find more useful than credit card numbers. You know, this is a little ugly, I think. You know, on the flip side, you know, you may not care that somebody might be able to get your, you know, Facebook access, you know, through your four-year-old Android phone. It's interesting.
Are we at the point where I need to, like, drive a nail through the NAND controller on the phone, like, we used to drive a nail through the hard drive to really make sure it was unreadable.
Well, you know, it's, you know, a long password's a good idea. It depends on how paranoid you are. I mean, you can, you know, it's not recommended that you smash a phone into small pieces before you recycle it, but that's certainly an option. You know, the you know, it's frustrating. I don't know what else to tell you. You know, I mean, it's also, that was, it reminds you of like one of the other announcements at Google I.O. Was that they launched what they call the Cloud Test Lab, which you upload your APK, essentially your files for an application, and Google will automatically test it against the top 20 Android devices, which may not sound like a big deal unless you've done development on Android and you've had to deal with the fact that there are 42,000 flavors. I exaggerate slightly, but let's say there's 100 commonly used Android phones, and they might have, you know, 2 to 6 different versions of the operating system, depending on how old they are. Exaggerating a little with 6, I think, but, you know, because the upgrades are coupled, or because the carriers control the upgrades, you know, you've heard me fuss about this before, because the carriers control the upgrades, you can have a severe problem with your phone that's been fixed but not be able to upgrade it.
Right.
So, you know, even if, you know, Google does have a fix for this, it still has to get pushed through all of the carriers. And given, you know, the age of the, it's messy. You know, it's one more thing about this is a good time to remember to secure things and change passwords and be careful how you manage things. And if you are seriously paranoid, sure, you know, smash your phone or drill a hole through your phone. But make sure you dispose of the remains in a place that does electronics recycling. It's interesting. You know, it's also curious, because one of the things that's come up in some of the commentary around Android is making money on the Android platform, which seems to be more difficult for developers than making money on iOS.
Yeah,
that's always a challenge.
It's always been the case.
A little beyond what we usually talk about on This Week in Computer Hardware. One last kind of businessy thing before we move on to the meat and potatoes of the podcast. Broadcom is being bought for $37 billion. Is the article up in the Wall Street Journal. You know, you may know Broadcom from pretty much from routers and networking devices. You've certainly used their products or run into their products.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but it's crazy. When you look at when you look at the amount of money, it's a huge amount of money being exchanged. Wall Street Journal says this is the largest technology acquisition ever, right? You know, even if you take out the fact that Lucent Technologies, when Ascend bought them, was grossly overpriced because it was the peak of the dot-com insanity. That was $23.9 billion. You know, Facebook spent $22 billion buying WhatsApp. Dell, you know, when Dell got bought up by Silver Lake, that was $21 billion. So this is a huge deal.
Yeah.
You know, like $17 billion in cash, $20 billion of its own shares.
You know what really surprises me on that list? WhatsApp, yeah, being acquired by Facebook.
Yeah,
for almost $22 billion.
Well, there was from a strategy aspect, WhatsApp is pretty much the, you know, when, you know, if you are Mark Zuckerberg and you fundamentally have controlling interest in your company because you hold or control the voting rights to so many shares, and you look to yourself and you can, you know, he's a smart guy, and he was like, okay, this is the most popular, you know, this is the most popular social application in the vast majority, you know, of the world. I can compete with them or I can buy them. I think it makes a lot of sense to buy them and sort of co-opt them into your universe, rather than trying to figure out this super lightweight client that's going to work on continents where you have no, no deep expertise. You know, I think it's going to be curious to see how this impacts, you know, some, not so much some of the deals that are coming out, but Broadcom itself, because there's such a, you know, there's such a big company. Avago is a spinoff from HP. You know, this is kind of a big deal, right? You know, for wireless communications, Broadcom's kind of everywhere. So I'm curious to see how this is going to impact them over time. It's interesting when you start looking, you know, I think I look at this night and my automatic response is like, okay, are they going to do more updates to my software or less? Are the drivers going to be updated faster or slower? You know, but that's one of the things in the Wall Street Journal notes is like, you know, NXP Semiconductors is buying Freescale. Intel is looking to buy Altera. You know, Qualcomm, you know, some of their investors are pushing them to break up. Yeah, it's I'm curious to see because it seems like the chip market is consolidating in a pretty big way. So
it appears to be.
Yeah.
Yep. What else is going on? Did you know about this Lenovo Tech World event that was happening?
No.
We don't have to talk about it very long. It's apparently just an event that they're having over in Beijing right before Computex. Mm-hmm. And they showed off some new notebooks, some Broadwell updates and some other stuff, a SAN and some other weird things. The most interesting thing they showed, I don't think there's a link here to it, is a phone with two screens. A watch with two screens.
Yeah, I saw the demo of that on PC Per, and I was like, what?
Like it has like a prism on the band that is like the Google Glass prism. And when you hold it up to your face, you look like a doofus, but you can see an image that they say is 20 times as the size of the watch face itself. It's probably one of those things that's very difficult to demo on camera, but
right. Hold the tiny screen up to your eye, and it appears to be a 65-inch screen.
I'm not sure where they're going with this. If it's something they're actually going to sell, I think they were still calling it a prototype. And then they also had what they call it, Reach It, that worked with Cortana, and it was an attempt to be able to use natural language search with Cortana to say, "Hey, Cortana, show me the pictures that are." Where are the pictures that I showed Tom last week? And it would attach that you were with Tom last week at a coffee shop, and these were the files you accessed while you were in that location, and then it would present them to you then, right? Or show me the presentation I worked on at the office yesterday. And it would be able to say, okay, it's using GPS data for where you were at. One or more presentations you looked at while you were at that office yesterday, and it kind of presents you those files. It's a really, really cool idea. But it's just one of those things that, you know, a cool demo video does not a good product make.
But it got a bunch of press coverage, and it's
they did.
It's a cool smartphone emerging technology that nobody else has made an announcement in this space. Nobody's doing a holographic watch yet. So in that sense, I think it makes a lot of sense. It probably gets them a huge amount of coverage in China.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, it's kind of unfortunate to be doing it against Google I.O., but
yes.
It's still going to stand out a lot more than... still going to stand out a lot more than it would say against, you know, some Anvil's announcements. Dude, what's going on with the AMD Radeon 300? When you say rebrands of existing 200 series cards, does that mean they aren't new cards? I mean,
difficult distinction to make. It's possible they could be just rebrands. It's possible they could be the same GPU on a new PCB with you know, a redesigned card itself, maybe a redesigned cooler. The hubbub in the rumor mill about the Radeon 300 series, which is something I think we talked about a few weeks ago when they showed off OEM product parts, is that the Radeon R9 300 series will essentially be pick and choose from your Radeon R9 200 series of parts and give them a new model number. According to this leak from a driver, the Radeon R9 290X will become a Radeon R9 300 series part, and the R9 290 will become an R9 300 series part. And we do know already that the R9 380, which exists as an OEM part that was announced by system vendors, has the same specifications essentially as an R9 285. So if the 380 is the same as the 285, then we assume that the 390s will be the same as the 290, 290X. which is interesting only because a lot of people, and we have been one of those groups, have been just assuming that whatever the new GPU from AMD coming out this year, the AMD Fiji part, will be just, we just have been using the term, oh yeah, the R9 390X. Clearly that doesn't appear to be the case. And AMD is either going to, Fiji will be a 400 series part, or maybe they will come up with some kind of unique branding, right? Like NVIDIA has the Titan. Maybe Fiji will be called Fiji. I don't know. Or Zeus or something, right? You know, something that's like a name as opposed to a model number. Otherwise, the leaks of all these different model numbers that are showing up don't make a whole lot of sense. It also kind of tells you that if you're a fan of AMD and you're looking for a new AMD product, you're really only going to get the new high-end parts again, right? You're going to get...
Right.
Fiji is going to be a new GPU. Everything else that's going to be for sale for NVIDIA, or I'm sorry, for AMD for the rest of this year is going to be products that already exist on the market, probably just renamed somewhat.
Somewhat.
Yeah. Hopefully that also means lower prices, I guess, right?
Right.
If you rebrand it, it's kind of getting a little stale, like it's not fantastic. But if you can lower the price of those parts along the way, then that would be good. The problem is AMD is in a weird spot where they've been dropping prices so quickly anyway.
Right. And
if Fiji comes out at the price point that we're all kind of expecting, $600 or so, then there's this huge gap between what Fiji is and what Hawaii will be as a 300 series part. So you can't, I don't know. It'll be an odd product stack if it works out that way, which I think we'll find out by the end of June. So
we wait with bated breath. We mentioned this super, super briefly last week with when Robert Herron was on. But let's talk about, and I would actually, let me rephrase this. I would like you to talk about high bandwidth memory and what's going on with AMD's Fiji. Because
that's right. That was last week, wasn't it? That was MIA.
So I thought HBM. I could try to explain it, but I would embarrass myself and irritate you. So.
Well, let's take a stab at it. So HBM stands for high bandwidth memory. It is a new implementation of memory that can be used with, in this case, we're talking about with the GPU, but there's no reason high bandwidth memory, HBM, couldn't be used with APUs or other processors like SoCs and mobile parts, technologically speaking. The idea is simple. If you look at that diagram on the post that you included there, on the left you have a typical GDDR5 memory configuration. It's what exists on all of NVIDIA's cards today, all of AMD's cards today. You get one DRAM piece of silicon sits on the substrate, and then that gets mounted to the board itself of the video card. With HBM, the first part of it is that it's stacked. You're going to take DRAM die and stack them on top of each other vertically. And obviously that gets you more density in terms of how much memory can you fit into a square millimeter of space on a board, right? So that's your first improvement. Your second improvement is just in bandwidth. A single stack of HBM will run at a bus width of 1,024 bits as opposed to 32 bits for a single stack chip of GDDR5.
That's a
significant difference. Now, there's usually 16 DRAM chips on a current generation graphics card. There will only be 4 stacks of HBM. So you take 32 times 16 and then you get 1,024 times 4. Still a big difference in favor of high bandwidth memory. The other big advantage is you're not mounting memory on the graphics card board itself. Now you are mounting it on an interposer. So it's hard to imagine this picture. If you go to the full story, you can get some better diagrams. When you see a chip today, there's a substrate, there's a silicon die sitting on top of it, and there you go. With HBM, you would actually have this interposer, which is just, think of it as a large kind of plate that you can put stuff on. And those things can connect to each other through that in a very high-speed way that they could not through a longer distance like a PCB. So you take a GPU, and then next to it, you stack these HBM towers, right, more or less. And because they are so close to the GPU and the bus width is so fast, they're getting upwards of 100 to 120 gigabytes per stack of bandwidth to the GPU. And they're doing that at a much lower clock speed. So the current, the first implementation of HBM will run at 500 megahertz, while GDDR5 today on the high-end cards runs at like 1750 megahertz. So even with that clock speed deficit, because of the higher bus width, you are going to get drastically increased bandwidth. Probably, even with this first generation, we're talking 50% to 100% improved memory bandwidth for that GPU, which is dramatic. The downside is the current implementation only supports four stacks, and we know that the stacks are going to be 1 gigabyte. So all indications are that AMD's Fiji GPU that will use the first iteration of HBM will be a 4 gigabyte maximum frame buffer memory size on those graphics cards. Now, the benefit is you get increased bandwidth, and you get some interesting size implementation changes as well. But because you don't have to have 16 different memory chips kind of mapped around a GPU, you save a lot of physical board space as well, which allows you to make smaller boards, put them in different locations, you know, smaller mini ITX style systems. This you could see, you could imagine Apple being really interested in this type of stuff when they're building their Mac Pro machines because of what they're trying to do with unique system design. Those are the advantages of this. It's a little bit more expensive because you have the interposer for now. And then the HBM2, which will be a 2016 to 2017 product, actually doubles the number of stacks you can have and doubles how high the DRAM stacks can go. So you can have 4 gigabyte stacks. So you won't have any capacity issues there. It is lower power as well. It's significantly more efficient because you're running at a lower clock speed. A whole lot of things on the GPU and on the memory logic can be made more simple because of the lower clock speed. It doesn't have to deal with these incredibly tight tolerances of, you know, 1700 to 2 gigahertz memory speeds. That allows them to lower power, make the memory system more efficient. And that's all good things, especially for AMD that has had struggles with power efficiency on their GPUs recently. It's not going to totally flip the table in AMD's favor because in general, memory is kind of like 10 to 15% of your total power budget, I guess, on a GPU and on a graphics card. So in that 10%, they're going to be able to go significantly lower than GDDR5. But I think the other benefits are more interesting than that, like the memory bandwidth, right? And people will, I think we'll have to, when that comes out and we do a review, people are going to be very concerned about, hey, 4K displays, Eyefinity multi-monitor displays, do I need to be worried about the fact that it only has 4 gigs of memory? If AMD is smart and they do all this correctly, they shouldn't have to worry about it because the additional memory bandwidth should alleviate some of that need to just have massive amounts of frame buffer. But I'm sure it's something NVIDIA will tout about having 6 gig and 12 gigabyte graphics cards, while AMD might have to be stuck at 4 for a full generation because of the new memory architecture. Does that make sense? There's a whole lot more detail. I would recommend, because Josh knows a lot about this as well. We talked about it on a podcast and we kind of cut that section out and made it a separate video on PC Per, where we dive into what that is. And if you're interested in something like through silicon vias, which is basically where they figure out how to drill tiny holes through pieces of silicon and then run copper through them so that you could have connectivity vertically. It's really neat stuff to see pictures of, for sure.
Like, one of the interesting questions, I think it may have been the first question that was posted in the comments up on PC Per, was, you know, what's preventing this from moving into non-volatile DRAM, i.e., will this be showing up on SSDs?
It's possible.
Or is it even necessary?
It's not as necessary because usually physical space is not a bottleneck for SSD implementation. And they're not usually going this fast. Like an SSD, even the top level SSDs, we're talking about a total of 2 gigabytes per second of bandwidth. These are capable of, you know, 100 gigabytes per second. It's DRAM versus flash. I think you'll be able, I don't know, Alan would know for sure because he did a lot of research on the TSVs, on the through silicon vias. I think that will be able to be utilized for NAND to be stacked, but I don't think it's going to have the same kind of performance implications as we're seeing here with the DRAM.
Good point. So if we're talking about, while we're talking about rumors, we'll just slide right over NVIDIA's GeForce's GTX 980 Ti specifications leaked. And by the way, seriously, Ryan's right. If you want to get deep on high bandwidth memory, definitely listen to the chunk of the podcast that they put up on PCPro.com. But it's interesting. Sebastian wrote this one on PC Per. Quote, who doesn't love rumor and speculation about unreleased products other than the manufacturers of such products? Of course, today, video cards with a Z is reported by a hardware battle, a GPU-Z screenshot reportedly showing specs for an NVIDIA GeForce GTX 980 Ti. Could this be a leak from NVIDIA? Could this be someone, you know, that is implementing this processor, making an oopsie and leaking their own? Sebastian notes that the hardware battle logo conveniently obscures the hardware ID as well as the ROP and TMU counts, but you can see that there's 2,816 shaders, which is in between a GTX 980 and a Titan X, and you know, pretty closer to the Titan X or the Titan 10 than the 980. 980's got 2,048 cores, and the Titan X has 3,072. 60 gigabytes of GDDR5 with a 384-bit interface. You know, so basically bandwidth should be similar to the Titan X. Identical clock speed to the Titan X. I think it's interesting. You know, I would be very curious to see what the pricing is like on something like this.
I think that's the most important part of this product when it comes out. You know, when we first saw the Titan X, I think everybody hypothesized, oh, we'll see a version with half that memory at a lower clock speed at a lower price. We just didn't know when or where. All indications are soon. And at least according to that table, it's kind of minimal in terms of specification decreases, which is could be good. Yeah.
Could be good. Logitech G showcase Q&A and giveaway. Logitech's building a completely unhinged gaming keyboard. And when I say unhinged, I mean that in kind of a nice way. Is that an accurate assessment of this?
Oh, you're talking about the 910 Orion Spark? That is...
I think so.
Yeah, that's out now. It's been available. Oh. Yeah, that was more of a collection of stuff that they wanted to show off and showcase there. It is a nice keyboard. It uses Omron switches, not Cherry. It is RGB. It has this really cool kind of, what did he call it? I'm going to use a different, like a concave kind of pattern to the keys. It's very, instead of rounded, it's kind of straight edged. It helps your fingers kind of find their placement easier. It has like a place to, actually, I think it's useful for other things, but on the edge of the keyboard, you can like put your phone or tablet kind of at an angle. It's kind of like got a stand right there. Handy even if you just like monitor your phone and notifications while you're using your keyboard, whether it be for gaming or for writing or whatever productivity stuff you're going to do. But it also has gaming implications for using open SDKs to access that tablet or that phone and present information. They demoed an SDK that lets game developers change the colors of the keys on the keyboard depending on what's happening in the game. So like he showed GTA 5 where as soon as you have a star rating, the function keys flash back and forth to blue and red like a police flashing lights on a police car. And it's like, okay, I can see how that's kind of interesting. It's fun. It's playful. He went through some other demonstrations about how you might use the number pad and show like fuel levels in a racing game and have the color decrease as it goes down. So some cool ideas there. But then the racing wheel rumor that you have in the show notes, he refused to talk about. Even off camera, he refused to acknowledge, didn't say anything about it. I'm excited. I've been thinking I needed a racing wheel for a long time, but I kept thinking like, nobody's released anything new in a while. Logitech hadn't released a new racing wheel since 2010.
Yeah. I mean, there's not much that's changed about them. So I thought it was really interesting. I mean, it's, Yeah, well, it's a good looking piece of hardware. It looks like it's going to be, you know, it looks like it's going to be console compatible. It's also, it's funny because you look at the design and it's very, you know, like the keyboard, for example, it's a really funny mix of like, oh, it's got crazy space warrior design action like Razer. And then you look at the keys and the key design and it's like, wow, that actually might be really, really useful in terms of, you know, as somebody who's a touch typist and types really fast, you know, and it needs to be really useful. It's a $180 keyboard.
Sure. You mention when they were first designing those keycaps, they actually were originally deeper, like further reduced into the keycap, and gamers loved it because it made it more simple to find your home row keys and find the place you want to go.
Right.
But for a multifunction device, like somebody who wanted to actually type and write reports and do that kind of stuff, they actually found that it was detrimental. So they lessened it some. So they found a balance of both that way.
Balance is good and critical. But that's all. If you haven't seen it, gaming.logitech.com is the new home of their gaming gear. I'll have to call them. I would like to get my grubby little fingers on one of those keyboards because that's pretty impressive looking. The Sapphire R9 285 ITX OC. Sapphire tackles the ITX scene. Is the short version of this is that you can get an R9 285 into your tiny case.
Yeah, pretty much. It is slightly overclocked. It's slightly overclockable above that. We don't see a lot of AMD cards in the mini ITX form factor. And a lot of that is because the power inefficiency we talked about before when we were, theorizing about Fiji and stuff. Because of that, it makes it difficult for aftermarket designers to try to get them into these small places. And so that's clearly, I think, the smallest 285 we've seen. It's right on par with, I think we've seen a GTX 970 in about the same form factor. But for AMD, that's as good as it's going to get for a little while. Now, if you look at the rumored leaked pictures of Fiji, of the new high-end Radeon card, it's not much bigger than that. Because of the HBM advantages we talked about just a second ago. But I think if it's going to be that small, it's probably going to require some water cooling goodness to get there. So the Sapphire card here is compact while also being air-cooled, which is important for a lot of people, especially in the small cases itself. So worth checking out if you are in the market for that, right? If you're not in the market for a small cooler or a small graphics card, don't bother. You're going to pay more for those cards, and they're not going to be as cooling efficient, right? Get a longer one. Get a larger heat sink. It'll maybe be a little bit quieter because of it, although Josh didn't have any issues with noise levels on this particular product. So, a good video card nonetheless.
Gigabyte Champion Series X99 Gaming 5P Motherboard. There's a review up on PC Pro by Maury Teitelman. Anything particularly outstanding about this particular X99 motherboard? I mean, it's kind of funny.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say it's kind of funny because it's like, oh, you know, if you scroll down, right? So it's relatively understated for an X99 motherboard. So you've seen so many that have like, you know, giant crazy logos, big stack of USB 3.0 ports, gigabit Ethernet, gold plated audio jacks. And then scroll down, it's like I was laughing because it's like, oh, you know, it's like a Creative Labs ad. There's upgradable op amps, super cool audio capacitors, although I've never really heard of bipolarized audio capacitors as a feature quite like that before. How was the performance?
Performance is fine, and that's kind of like the trouble with all motherboards is the performance is fine.
Just another X99.
Yeah, we've seen so many X99 motherboards. This one does some interesting stuff right there. You can see it's got the power IR, power stage, MOSFET technologies. It's got the replaceable op amp for the audio system. It separates the analog audio signal through its own layer of the PCB and motherboard. They do a lot of cool stuff. It's just things we have seen on other Gigabyte motherboards for a year or so or more. So it's it's kind of difficult to talk to again over and over. But I mean, it is a good solid product. You can see it's got support for 4 graphics cards. If your case has support for it, you know, SLI and Crossfire with that. You still got the 8 DIMM slots. This is still the highest end flagship platform you're going to get from Intel for quite some time. You know, if you get a processor to go along with it, a Haswell E. Other than that, I mean, it overclocked fine. It's a $300 motherboard. It sounds expensive, but most X99 right. motherboards these days are around $300. I guess they figure if you're buying a $500 or $1,000 CPU, $300 motherboard won't make you won't phase you too much. It's hard to go budget on that platform.
No, it is.
Although DDR4 memory has come down in price. I've been surprised how quickly that's happened. Actually, yeah. Jeremy was mentioning that yesterday. You can get like 16 gigs of DDR4 for like $140 now, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Interesting article up on Recode earlier this week. Who was bought apparently by Vox, The Verge.
Company
owns The Verge. Yeah. And what's interesting is apparently Comcast has options or investments in both Recode and Vox and could potentially own all of those companies, which is a little businessy for us. But yeah. Well, the article is interesting. Oculus Rift, total package price around $1,500. So the Oculus CEO said the soon to be available virtual reality Oculus headset and the computer needed to run it will cost, quote, in the $1,500 range, unquote. So, you know, they still haven't announced the price of the headset.
Yeah. I was going to say, that's the important part is that when people hear $1,500 for Oculus Rift, that includes a computer, not one specific that they're selling you, but that's their estimate. It's like, and if you build a computer that meets the specifications that we've put it forth, it should be about $1,500 total.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've actually had a couple of requests in, like, from people, like, just kind of in the gaming industry side of things. Like, hey, we heard that story, and so we went to build a system kind of based on what they publicly stated about their minimum wex. What do you think about this bill? And I'll look through it and change a couple things. Here's what I would do with that. But they're all kind of targeting the $1,200 range. Mm-hmm. So it gives you an idea of the $300 range left for the headset, in theory.
Yeah.
So
it's interesting. We just did this week, the episode of Tech Thing is about to go up this afternoon. Shannon finally built her gaming PC, Core i5, really nice GPU, you know, 16 gigabytes of RAM because we go excessive on RAM around here. And it's funny, like, you know, she got a really good deal. Probably would have been much closer to $1,400 if she had hadn't gotten a smoking deal on the Core i5 CPU that was inside of there. It was ended up being under $200. You know, but I laughed because the quote that Mr. Kurt Wagner posts up on Recode is that over time he'd like to see that cost come down to under $1,000. So, you know, this is the company owned by Facebook, and the big issue here is probably going to be less about the cost of the Oculus Rift, you know, which might be $300 or $400, I would expect, but the fact that you're going to need a pretty badass machine to power it. That will be interesting. I'll also be curious when they actually announce the price and the ship date and all of that good stuff.
Yep.
HP Sprout and Dremel Idea Builder. I feel like I should have spent more time with this at Maker Faire. But it's an interesting kind of idea. I like the idea of it, but the demo wasn't particularly compelling, and I had a 3-year-old attached to my head at the time. but it's essentially, it was late in the day. It was a good day at Maker Faire, but Seamus was trying to figure out how to get it to do some stuff. But it was an interesting demo in the sense of that the idea here, which you're looking at there, is a 3D scanner mounted above a 23-inch touchscreen, 1080p all-in-one. With a fair amount of zoot, you know, it's Core i7 4790S. But the HP Illuminator is the interesting part, which is a DLP projector with an Intel RealSense 3D camera and a standard, you know, 14.6 megapixel camera. Jeremy writes up on PCPro.com. So the DLP projector, and I'm just going to read straight from Jeremy's description. The DLP projector is used to project a virtual workspace onto a 20-point capacitive touch mat that's placed in front of the Sprout, which allows you with the RealSense camera to scan 3D objects and save them as .obg files, which you can then, because they're partnered with Dremel, who's coming very, very late to the 3D maker scene, that you can, the idea is that you're going to scan a real-life object and then print it with Dremel's Idea Creator, and I presume any other, 3D printer over time. Right. You know, there's a stylus that comes with it. It was interesting to see the kind of display because it couldn't quite figure out what was going on, which is unfortunate because the idea of having a decent scanner, and I think it's, for me, that's one of the things that would be killer as a 3D app. And also, I think, for people who manufacture things for a living, kind of terrifying, because if people can make a really good copy of something, and making a really good copy of something is not nearly as simple as scanning in an object and hitting print, because if you spend any time with a 3D printer, you'll find it's all of the little things that go into making something structurally sound that makes it much more complicated than you would think. Yeah. I do like the idea of having, a scanner at home. I still haven't found one. We've seen some at CES, but none of them seem to have shipped.
makes it difficult really to want... use if they're not available.
Well, either the ones that have shipped are so far beyond, anything I can remote. Much easier. This is not a, it's funny because I'm looking at the HP Sprout website, which is, of course, I get the UK one. Maybe there is only a UK one. Sprout.hp.com. Oh, wait, US. Hold on. See, try buy. Because it's $1,800. Excuse me, £1,800 in the UK. And to buy it in the US is brace for impact, ladies and gentlemen. HP, you make big servers. Come on.
They don't make big internets. Well, maybe they do. I don't know the answer to that.
They should. There we go. May 28, 2015, ready to ship, $1,899. Interesting. I can't justify, it's funny because I keep trying to find specs for, the level of detail that the Illuminator can cap. Oh, my goodness. My. Sorry, everyone, especially everyone who was in the control room at the Brick House. pull up the Sprout webpage. I was hoping to find more information on the actual specs on what it's scanning, but that seems to be relatively classified information. Although I got to say,
it's using an Intel RealSense camera. Yeah. Which I have a little bit of experience with, at least. It can't be super high resolution then. And if it's only using one camera, to do a real 3D scan, you'd have to have at least a couple.
Yeah.
Right, to get all the angles and stuff, unless you're just rotating it or something like that. But I think we'll be there sooner than most people want to believe, like the scan it, print it, make as many copies as you want type of thing.
Uh-huh.
But I think it'll be fun.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. It's amazing how fast, as we've been playing around with those little Hubson quadcopters. My son's gotten really into flying them, and of course, we finally had an epic fail that took out one of the propellers, which we've done before, but also took out the bumper that goes around it and did some other damage. And what's been really, really fun is finding that there's all these 3D printable objects that people have created up on Thingiverse and other places that we can download and print. So instead of, ordering another, 2-cent piece of plastic from Amazon, we can print out our own 2-cent piece of plastic on a 3D printer. And it's one of those moments where it's like, this is so awesome. Oh, wow. People have figured out decent AR-15 grips on here. Hey, here's an adapter to hold this onto that. And I'm really curious to see how long it takes the price of 3D printers to come down. And the thing I really want most is something And several companies are working on it, a furious pace, Autodesk being a particularly good example, which is making the software you use to create 3D objects much simpler and easier to use. Because I hit an epic brick wall every time, no matter what application I've tried to use. I still find myself going like, gosh, you know, if I hadn't, you know, an architect square and a pencil, I could draw this up like immediately.
Yeah.
So that's something I'm going to have to spend some quality time with.
Drafting applications tend to have fairly high learning curves, I've found. Yeah. So, yeah.
Oh, man. One last one before we go. We got a tweet from Dan, who's at Casper042. At Ryan Shrout, when you and at Patrick Norton talk about enterprise tech, 18-core E7, it makes me cringe. I'm a little behind on my Twitch, which is a fair cop.
Sure.
It was Xeon E7 is for big iron like databases and SAP HANA. I can't see anybody using it for video editing, and 7,000 a processor. And it's interesting because, of course, people who live in the world of big data and giant servers where everything costs all the money. Dan goes on to add E7 is socket R1/2011, but different than E5 and X99. Same socket as Xeon E7 V2, and we'll do DDR3 or DDR4. And I got to say, I got to give a shout out props to Dan for taking the time to type all this out. You know, 140 characters at a time on Twitter. E5 2600, E5 1600 are server versions of X99 CPUs. Way more likely for video editors at only 4K for 18-core 2699. It's a good, it's a good series of tweets. And lastly, the Xeon E3 V2 is an S1155 Sandy/Ivy Core i5 i7 with Xeon E3 V3 S1150 Haswell i5 i7 with the Xeon badge, which is a kind of an interesting kind of inside baseball moment on that one.
Yeah.
And then Dan says, I expect to see the E7 V3 upgrade to this beast at some point. 288 cores, 24 terabytes of RAM. Which sounds utterly ridiculous until you talk to somebody who, say, is working on the back end at Amazon. And when going down is not simply, it's just not an option.
I believe you asked how much 24 terabytes of RAM would cost, and he replied, yes, it's going to be a bit over $2 million just for the RAM. Oh, actually, he corrected himself, only $1.92 million list price.
So
that's based on purchasing 64 gigabyte DIMMs.
Wow. And it was interesting because one of the things I pointed out to Dan is, like, on one hand, 7,000 or even 4,000 sounds ridiculous for a desktop processor, but I've talked to people, and it is for any normal human being. But if you are, say, working on, if you are a production company that makes commercials where somebody's spending $500,000 to, several million dollars to create this, 30-second masterpiece, or people that are working down in Hollywood on broadcast or movies, if it will significantly decrease the amount of time it takes to render, or significantly increase an editor's or, any other person in the production chain, their productivity, when you're looking at spending $30, $50, $100 million on a movie, $10, $15, $20,000 in hardware is an insignificant cost. But yeah, and Dan's right. For the normal human beings, no, these are not going to be anything that they would remotely consider using unless they stumbled across one at a garage sale 10 years from now.
Sounds like a good deal still.
Yeah. and the E5, as Dan points out, is cheaper and does the same job. So should you be in the market for a $4,000 18-core CPU, we're going to note Dan's recommendation on the E5 2600.
There you go.
And I know at least one editor that read that tweet was like, yeah, I just need to get work to pay for it.
That's always a good idea. In my case, when I say that, it doesn't have the same effect, but I know what they mean. Yeah.
I know what they mean. With that, we're going to remind everybody that the best way to contact us, although we love tweets at Patrick Norton and at Ryan Trout, if you'd like to string larger sentences together in a single document, feel free to email twitch@twit.tv, and we try to keep our eye on that. We're going to do some more questions next week. There was just a ton of news today for us to cover, so we didn't do too many questions. We want to thank Dan, aka at Casper042, for his commentary and helping us keep it real. And we want to thank each and every one of you for listening. If this is your first episode of Twitch, do us a favor. Subscribe. Go over to twit.tv/TWICH, and you can find all the links to subscribe to the show. Whether you want the audio or the video is completely up to you, and we think it is delightful in either format, and we encourage you to subscribe so you don't miss any shows. PCPer.com is the main home of Mr. Ryan Shrout, who, if a tweet I saw in the last 48 hours is correct, where you are underneath a gigantic pile of hardware that is being benchmarked.
Man, it's been a long time since I can because I can remember having this much stuff like sitting. Like I went on vacation for four nights, 4 days.
Right.
And I came back and there was like boxes of stuff stacked up against one of the walls that had been delivered. And so it's a tough job, I know, dealing with all this cool new hardware, but it gets unreal sometimes, just the amount of stuff that you got to do. Like the amount of rush I was in to try to get this Shield review out this morning, this afternoon, whenever it was. It feels like it was forever ago already.
Is it up already?
Yeah. Yeah. It went up at 3 p.m. Eastern just now.
Right after I did the okay,
yeah.
Darn it, Ryan. Yeah. So I should just cancel my order.
we'll talk about it next week.
Yeah, I guess I'll.
It's a good product. It's a really good product. Right. There's the secret, but it all depends on the success of Android TV. So
right,
we'll see how it goes.
Which is all about negotiating access to content and. Mr. Ryan Trout says, we'll talk about that next week. If you want to see a gaming PC being built really fast and mock the way I apply thermal compound, feel free to check out episode 21 of Tech Thing, which goes live just a couple hours from now at techthing.com or on iTunes or youtube.com/techthing. It's Shannon Morris and I geeking out. We have a lot of fun actually answering questions about why she picked the components she picked for her gaming PC. And we basically do a fast forward through a PC build. So it ends up taking about 6 or 8 minutes. We also have my three favorite digital measuring tools, one of which involves electricity, one of which involves heat, and one of which involves sound. And the clever amongst you are already looking on Amazon to find out what I might have been talking about. So we should... probably end it there before I start laughing intermittently in between sentences again, because apparently my allergy medicine has finally kicked in. And while I still can't breathe, I'm getting goofy as all heck. So, on that bright and cheerful note, we want to thank everybody for listening to Twitch. New episodes come out each and every week. You can find them at twit.tv/twit. And with that, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.